This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
I came across an article recently by a career guidance service that has analyzed 200 jobs in our culture and then ranked them from best to worst. The best jobs they called dream jobs, and the worst jobs they called non-dream jobs. If you wanted to live the dream, you needed to follow, you know, their advice, I suppose. According to their analysis, among the top dream jobs were software engineers, financial planners, occupational therapists, and others. The non-dream jobs, according to them, were dishwashers, meter readers, and roofers. So if you wanted a dream job, work on a computer, not on a roof. This isn't really new. In fact, none of that's true. A few years ago, excavations uncovered in Egypt a school text. It had been originally scribbled down by students 1,700 years before the birth of the Lord. And they were copying down a text that had been assigned them, and the text was really career counseling. It was encouraging them to become scribes, to get into academia and avoid other jobs. And so the text discouraged them from other occupations like, and I quote, a small building contractor who carries mud, dirtier than pigs he becomes from all that mud. Another line discouraged them from becoming embalmers, quote, whose fingers are foul for the odor thereof. Another line warned them of becoming laundrymen because they would be washing the laundry on the river next to the crocodile who could eat them. So the dream job would not be doing laundry or working at a funeral home or putting up a building. The dream job would be becoming a scribe, a teacher, a writer. Frankly, nothing's changed. In thousands of years, there are still those giving advice on what would give fulfillment, what would be the dream job, and if you just had it, then you'd really have it. Frankly, to this day, Monday morning is probably the most frustrating time in anybody's calendar as they go back to work, as they drive or walk or whatever, wondering, is this really it? Of course, the bigger issue is that the world is desperately trying to find some kind of meaning for living, and they're trying to find it on Monday morning. They're trying to pursue it, and maybe they'd catch it if they add another one, a different one. And the frustration is only building. In fact, one journal article I came across reported that work is dominating Americans' lives like never before. Workers are piling on hours at a rate not seen since the Industrial Revolution, but it's really not bringing fulfillment. The article reported employees are feeling more and more insecure and unfulfilled. Work, and this is from a secular journal, work is not satisfying life's deepest needs. Well, that's not news. And that's not new, frankly. Solomon discovered that centuries before those Egyptian schoolboys ever wrote down the advice they were given to avoid doing the laundry. And I'm all about that advice, by the way, in case you're wondering. If anybody had a dream job, Solomon had it. You couldn't come up with a more dreamy occupation than the one he had. And yet what he says about his career might surprise you. So take your copy of Solomon's private journal called the Book of Ecclesiastes if you're new to our study and go to chapter 2 where we left off. And while you're turning, let me tell you ahead of time, Solomon is going to basically announce that he's had a lot of jobs, but none of them brought him any kind of fulfillment. He never found it on the treadmill. None of them brought satisfaction. We're at chapter 2, and let's pick it up at verse 18. Just the first phrase where Solomon blurts out, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun. You could paraphrase this to read, I hated every job I ever had. Thank you, Solomon. Tell us how you really feel. That's how he really feels. Maybe you've arrived here. Maybe that's how you're feeling right now. Glad I have a job, but I hate it. I dread the next shift. I dread clocking in tomorrow morning. Just the thought of getting in the car and heading to that job just makes my spirit sink. Think about all the jobs you had. Solomon's an old man, and he's sort of looking backward at all the jobs he ever had. And he comes to the conclusion, I didn't like any of them. None of them satisfied. Maybe you felt the same way. I remember as a 13-year-old, I had a lawn job. I had about 8 lawns. Hated every minute of it. But I did it. Well, I had my best friend in the neighborhood. Ronnie was his name. He was a paper boy. And I thought, you know, maybe that's it. That's the dream job. So I asked him if I could tag along one morning, and he agreed. He was happy for the help. The only thing is, I was sitting in his garage at 4:30 in the morning folding newspapers and then tagging along on the bicycle, loaded down. And about 6:30, by 6:30 that morning, I knew God was calling me into the ministry. Anything had to be better than that. And that was tough. Well, Solomon is looking back and he's saying he's filled with this hate. By the way, the word for hate is a word in the Hebrew language that can be translated disgust or intense dislike. There's not a job on the planet I've ever had, he says, that I didn't intensely dislike. Why was that? Well, he's going to give us several reasons why he hated Monday morning, so to speak, and every day after that. Here's why everything he had ever done left him unfulfilled. Let me give you the first one. I'm going to give you 4 of them, but let me give you in principled form the first reason why. Number one, because he's going to leave behind everything he's earned and accomplished. Look at verse 18 again. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Everything he'd rattled off earlier in his journal about all those parks, all those gardens, all those orchards, all those vineyards, all those houses, it's hitting him. As an old man, it's confronting him that now somebody else is going to vacation in that park. Somebody else is going to move his furniture into my house, you know, a day after I die. I'm going to leave it all behind. Solomon really didn't want to share it with anybody. You remember, if you've been with us, he really wants it all for himself. Earlier in this chapter, remember how he emphasized in his journal the word I, me, myself? He says, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. He writes in verse 4. I gathered for myself silver and gold. It was all mine. It was all for me. So what's driving him to distraction is the fact that he's going to leave every bit of that behind to somebody else. And it distresses him. The second reason Solomon is feeling entirely unfulfilled is that he can't guarantee that what he leaves behind will be managed well. Look at verse 19. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Who knows if he's going to know how to handle this or not? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. This is vanity. This is frustration. This is futility. He's basically saying, oh, the futility of the thought that somebody is going to inherit everything that I've accomplished, and they're probably not going to have the street smarts, they're probably not going to have the business savvy to manage it as well as I've managed it. He's concerned that an unworthy heir is going to take everything and inherit what he's built. There are many Old Testament scholars that I've been researching for our studies, and most of them believe that he has Rehoboam in mind when he writes this. His younger son, or the son he has that's going to sit on the throne, is arrogant, spoiled, foolish. Solomon is worried that his legacy isn't going to last one generation. Well, let me tell you, if he only knew his worries, it ain't going to last a week. By the time you get to about day 10, after the death of Solomon, Rehoboam blows it all away. I can't help but think of the newspapers today that are filled with the stories of wealthy heirs that squander the inheritances of their parents who slaved away and decades of difficulty and hard work, and they inherited and they just party it away. But what about somebody that doesn't want to carry on the legacy you've established? They're not necessarily going to party it away, but they just couldn't care less about what you've done with your life. What if they don't care about parks? What if they don't care about palaces? They want to live outdoors and backpack. What if they don't care about vineyards or orchards? They don't want any of that. What then? One of the authors I'm reading in my study wrote about his childhood. He had this neighborhood store in his area where he lived. Maybe you had one of those. I had one of those as well. He said it was open early in the morning, didn't close until late at night. That man kept that store running 7 days a week. He wrote, "I never saw that man outside that store except at the crack of dawn when he was walking his dog. Other than that, he lived in there. His wife, every so often, would come over and be behind the counter. This man had devoted his entire life to the little neighborhood store. In fact, he died in that store helping a customer." This author writes, in his early 20s, this man passed away, and a few days later, that store was up for sale. And that man's wife was showing everybody the brochure of the cruise she was going to take around the world with the money she got from that store. And he said he could almost hear that proprietor rolling over in his grave. Solomon is driven to distraction. What's going to happen to this business? What's going to happen to those parks, these houses, that palace, this kingdom? And it's driven him to hate Monday morning, so to speak, and every day. He can't find fulfillment, and he's terribly worried about what happens after he's gone. Thirdly, Solomon writes this in principle for him: he can't enjoy his accomplishments because they will be enjoyed by somebody who didn't work for them. And again, Solomon is self-absorbed here. He's not our example. But he's still put it out there, and he's putting it in writing what a lot of people think. Maybe we think it as well. Look at verse 20. "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed," key word there, "enjoyed by somebody who didn't toil for it. They didn't slave over it. They didn't sweat over it. They're going to enjoy it. This also is vanity and a great evil." I mean, he says this just isn't right. Somebody's going to enjoy apples from that orchard who didn't plant that tree. Somebody's going to stroll through that park that didn't spend hours building it. "I spent hours designing those palaces with the architects, and as soon as I'm dead, somebody's going to move their furniture in the bedroom. I mean, this can't be right." See, Solomon is old enough, and he's giving us practical wisdom from his journal. He's coming to terms with the fact that everything he has built, and he's from the crack of dawn till late at night, 7 days a week, unless he, being a faithful Jew, which he doesn't seem to have been, took Saturday off. But why would this bother him so much? So what if somebody eats apples from a tree you planted, they didn't? So what if somebody enjoys a stroll through a park and you planted the flowers? So what if somebody moves into that house you built? Why is that such a big problem to Solomon, driving him to such distraction? Well, we're given a clue in his fourth complaint. And here's the complaint in principle form. Then we'll look at the text. Number four, he worked around the clock to buy everything he could, which left him little time to enjoy anything he had. That's why. That's why the key word is enjoyment. Look at verse 22. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a maddening frustration, you could translate it. Even in the night, his heart doesn't rest. He's got his cell phone on. He's answering email. He hears the swish of it coming into his phone. Can't turn it off. Even at night, his heart doesn't rest. This also is futility. You see, here's the point. Solomon never enjoyed those apples. Solomon never enjoyed taking a stroll through that park. He never enjoyed his palaces. He's like one of the kings of Great Britain I learned recently who centuries ago built a palace he never once visited. And it was beautiful, right by the river. See, the problem isn't with palaces. It isn't with possessions. The problem is priorities. The problem isn't with our things. The problem is with our thinking. Let me put it this way. It's not wrong to have things money can buy, unless you have no interest in things money cannot buy. And Solomon has excluded God from the equation. He can't then enjoy whatever it is he's been building. He can't just sit down and enjoy the view, because he's squandering, and he's squandered decades of his life without God. Maybe I'll find meaning on Monday if I work harder, if I move faster, if I get up earlier. Maybe significance will greet me when I clock in. Not a chance. Now with that as backdrop, Solomon makes this surprising turn in his journal. He's going to do it six times. This is the first of six times. He's going to straighten everything out. He's going to move away from his testimony, and he's going to tell us what's right and what he should do. Then he's going to go back to his testimony and his years of wandering. So let me take what he's going to give us and put them in two principled forms as we go through the rest of this chapter. Here's the first principle. Your station in life is a gift from the hand of God. Look at verse 24. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, you exclude him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? This is the first time, you notice, that Solomon talks about really, truly enjoying anything. He hasn't enjoyed anything. Yeah, he's had pleasures, but not enjoyment. And suddenly he's talking here about enjoying your meal, your food, your job. One author wrote that this is kind of like a beam of light, a shaft of light, inspired light, you know, beaming through, breaking through the gloom of this journal. Solomon hates his job, and now he enjoys his job. What made the difference? God. God. The perspective that God has brought this about, that I'm in the hand of God, that I'm receiving what I have from God, that to God alone belongs glory for whatever is accomplished, and I can enjoy this because God is allowing me to experience it. This is the Apostle Paul writing to Timothy, that God gives us all things to enjoy. 1 Timothy 6:17. It's interesting that historically, the nation Israel will read the book of Ecclesiastes during the Feast of Tabernacles. That's the time when they remember that everything they have is from the hand of God. So whatever they enjoy comes from God. So that isn't just a job, that's a gift from God. That isn't just a meal, that's a gift from God. So whatever it is, enjoy it. Make the most of it. I mean, it might be a plate of pork and beans and then a hot dog sliced up and tater tot. That's actually a good meal. It's early. It's getting close to noon. You know how it is. You can, if you're walking with God, enjoy that. You exclude God and you can't enjoy filet mignon. In fact, if you think about where your life's going, you cut a slice of that filet mignon, without God, you can't enjoy it. You're driving to work without God, denying God, excluding God, and if you have the thought, what does my life really mean? And I know I'm not going to find it when I show up. So what do? You just turn the radio on louder. Got to drown those thoughts out. That's why we read of people who've reached the pinnacle of success taking their lives. Because they've come to the realization, none of this brings fulfillment or significance or joy. Your job, you might be a roofer, a dishwasher. You might be an engineer. It's a gift from the hand of God, which means a satisfied life can be found when you stop looking for another one. Life that truly satisfies can only be found and enjoyed when we stop looking for another one, demanding from God another one, but accepting what God has given us and making the most of it. Williams translates it this way as he records 1 Corinthians 7:17, where Paul is encouraging the Corinthian believers, and he writes, "Everyone needs to continue to live in the station where the Lord has assigned him." Now, that doesn't mean you can't change your job. You might long for the day when you can quit that job working on computer code and be up there on that roof with that guy shingling. Oh, man, that is the job. We find our satisfaction in the hand of God who is ultimately shepherding our lives. Principle number two, your station in life should produce gratitude for the grace of God. He writes in verse 26, for to the one who pleases him, don't misunderstand that. Hebrews 11:6 tells us that without faith it is impossible to please him. So he's talking about the believer who's in relationship with him. God has what? Given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the unredeemed, the sinner, the unbeliever, he has given the business of gathering and collecting. And in other words, that's all they'll ever do is work 9 to 5 or 9 to 9 or look forward to the weekend and dread Monday. That's all they'll get. They've excluded God from the equation. All they'll ever do is gather and collect. And then he makes this veiled reference, which is another study, but at least let me mention it here, of the redeemed one day inheriting the earth. Where he says this, he has given the business to the unbeliever of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases him, the one in relationship to him, where Jesus would say in Matthew chapter 5, the meek, the believer, will one day inherit the earth. All they do who deny him is gather and collect only to lose it all in the end. Solomon writes, this also is vanity and a striving after wind. The only thing they'll ever get is a fistful of air. So here's the contrasting perspective from Solomon's journal. We could apply it and translate it into the vernacular of our lives to this day. Without God, Monday morning is just another meaningless arrival. But with God, Monday morning is another assignment. Without God, Monday morning is senseless, and you get old enough and you realize he really is. But with God, it becomes sacred. Without God, Monday morning is just another act of drudgery. With God, Monday morning gives opportunities for more devotion. You see, Monday morning work can be just as meaningful as Sunday morning worship. The problem is we have to revive that Reformation doctrine of vocation. Have you ever thought about the fact that nowhere in your Bible is the phrase full-time Christian service? Nowhere. Why? Because every one of us are full-time in Christian service. God is as involved in your life on Monday as he is today on Sunday. Martin Luther, the Reformer, wrote that worship then can take place not only in church, he writes, but in the kitchen, the cellar, the workshop, and the field. So whatever you're doing, writing code or doing laundry, a roofer or a dishwasher, that's your assignment for now from God. He may shepherd you in a different direction one day. For now, that's it. Make the most of it. Take that assignment on. And then by the way that you serve and the way that you work, demonstrate that which builds a bridge into the lives of those around you, because they can't understand why you would ever show up on Monday morning with a song instead of a sigh. I saw that played out yesterday in real life. Yesterday, I had to drop off a package at the post office. The little one down here on Tryon Road, nobody knows it's there. Don't you start going there. The lines are very short. About two or three of us in there. There's only one guy working behind the counter. It's a small office, post office. I put him in his late 20s, early 30s. I'd never seen him before. And I could hear music playing in the background. Couldn't make out, you know, what it was. Every once in a while, he would just sort of absentmindedly, as he's working, just kind of sing one of the phrases. I couldn't make out what he was singing, but he was having a great time. When it was my turn at the counter, I joked with him that the post office ought to double his salary because he's not only serving us but doing it with a song. That was fantastic. He kind of laughed and weighed my package and sang another line. And then I realized it was a Christian song. It was a Christian artist coming out of his little boomboxy head there with a CD in there. I stood there thinking, wow, this guy's singing. Doesn't he know he's working in the post office? How many people are going to show up with joy and a song on their lips? And I wanted to say something, but really couldn't think of anything to say. He handed me my receipt after a couple of seconds, and he looked at me and he said, hey, God is in total control of everything. All I could say was, amen, brother. Amen to that. You see, that guy had taken God to work with him. God had clocked in right along with him. So instead of a sigh, he had a song. And he's delivering to his world as God gives him opportunity. The message Solomon writes here. Everything is from the hand of God. God is in control, which means the only life that satisfies is the life that finds its satisfaction and its meaning. Not in Monday morning, but in him. Father, thank you for the counsel of Solomon through hard decades of experience that he doesn't want us to repeat, to learn these lessons without wasting a life excluding you. Sometimes, Father, we think that you live here. This is where you stay. Certainly you couldn't be involved in where I'm going to go tomorrow morning. Nor would you care. And your word tells us something entirely differently. You care deeply. In fact, that job, that meal, that set of clothing, that automobile, those are gifts from your hand. Would you give us even greater gratitude, Father, with the life that you have given us now? It may change. What we have is now. Might we do less sighing and more singing?
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.